Okay. I'm going to start Perek Ches, Shiftim Perek Ches. From Pasuk Yud Ches. Perek Ches, Pasuk Yud Ches. You saw last week that Gideon completed the battle against Midian. He had wiped out most of their army in the initial campaign, which was in Eretz Yisrael itself. After he wiped them out, then the remaining 15,000 or so fled across the Jordan. Remaining 15,000 fled across the Jordan. Gideon chased them out there, and now he's coming back victorious, having captured the last two captains, the last two kings of the Midianites, Zebach and Zalmunna. So he's captured them, he's come back to Eretz Yisrael. Vayomer el Zebach ve'el Zalmunna. So now Gideon says to Zebach and Zalmunna, Eifoy ha'anoshim asher haragtem b'tavor. What's with the people you killed in Tavor? See, when the Zebach and Zalmunna were fleeing, they were still big shots. We already saw last week. It wasn't like after they were beaten in Eretz Yisrael and the first two kings of Midian, Ze'ev and Erev, were killed, that the other ones just fled with their tails between the legs. No, they fled as big shots. When they crossed the Jordan, they were busy destroying Jewish territory on the other side of the Jordan. In addition, they also conducted a massacre. They killed a lot of people in the area of Tavor. So now when Gideon caught them, he says to them, what's the nature of the people? Who did you kill at Tavor? Vayomru. And they answered, Kamoicha Kamoyim. Basically, you and they are the same. What does this mean? Echad Ketoya Pnei Melech. Kamoicha Kamoyim Echad. Basically, you're the same. Ketoya Pnei Melech. All of you have princely features. All of you have the look of kings. So, what they were basically saying was, we killed their people who look like you. He had family there. Vayoymar, and he said, Achai b'nei imihe. You're right on when you said that they looked like me. Those are my maternal brothers. Chai Hashem, lu hachayisem oisem lehavati yizcha. And he says, by the life of Hashem, had you left them alive, I wouldn't kill you. So now let's just know exactly what's happening here. The truth is that what they told him was a little more than that. They told him, Kamoicha Kamayim, and what they were telling him was, why are they stressing the princely features? The truth is that the Mefarshim say, the Malbim says what they were saying is, they were acting like kings, meaning these people were still talking to Gideon as though they were really the rightful bosses of Eretz Yisrael. And they were telling him, you know why we killed them? We killed them because they were acting like you are. They were acting like Balabas, like the bosses. And therefore, we construed that as a rebellion against us. That's why we killed them. And the truth is, we do the same to you, they're telling him now. We do the same to you too. You're a rebel. Right? It's still not, that's still not relating to him. You're a rebel. There's no legitimacy to what you did. And therefore, we would kill you if we could. So he says, okay. Now he says, all right. Well, the mice said, these were my brothers, and therefore I'm going to kill you. Had you kept them alive, I wouldn't kill you now. But now he's going to kill them. And he told Yeser, his firstborn, Kum haroi goisa, get up and kill them. But the youth could not bring himself to draw his sword, kiyore, because he was afraid, because he was still young, he was still a youth. Now let's note, it doesn't mean that he was 5 years old. He had actually come out for the battle, right? He was one of the 300 men that was chosen for this war, obviously. He was still among the 300 men who were with Gideon. But yeah, here we're seeing once again, between the lines, the nature of the Jewish people is being brought out. Right? These were people who couldn't kill. These were people who couldn't kill.
So he was the oldest of 70 brothers?
Yes, yeah, soon we'll see that there are actually 70 of them. So again, presumably we're not talking about a kid. We're not talking about a kid. Especially since we already saw that Gideon himself wasn't all that old when this took place. Whatever it is, presumably we're not talking mamish about a kid. We're talking about someone who's relatively young, but he wasn't able to actually bring himself to kill. So let's again note this, right? Let's again note this. The difference between the Jewish people and the world at large. Killing, wars, being a warrior was basically what was glorified in those times. There's certainly no such thing as human rights. But here, once again, you see the purity of the Jewish people. This kid wasn't able to bring himself to do it. But yet, Gideon is going to go ahead with it. He's going to kill the captured kings of Midian. So Zebach and Zalmunna, the two captive Midian kings, are seeing the discussions going back and forth, who's going to have the covet of killing them. So Zebach and Zalmunna said, "Kum ata ufgabanu, you get us and kill us. You get up and kill us. Ki ka'ish gvur asai, according to the strength of a man, to strength, meaning strength is according to the man. We want a true mighty warrior to kill us." Hey, they have orders, right? But Gideon respected their request. He did it with pleasure. I don't know if he did it with pleasure, but Vayakam Gideon Vayaroig es Zebach ves Zalmunna. And Gideon got up and he killed Zebach and Zalmunna. Vayikach es Saharoinim asher betzavrei gimaleim. And he took the moon-shaped ornaments that were on the necks of their camels. So first of all, let's just note. Was it necessary to kill them? Let's ask a question from the perspective of the 21st century Westerner, right? Was it necessary to kill them? That's it. They're like a capture.
It would be like Sisyphus.
That what?
That they can rebuild something. If they can get away, they can rebuild something.
So you could say, yes, if they would get away, they would rebuild something. But again, if we're going to approach it from the modern day perspective, right, so keep them locked up. Keep them locked up. Was it necessary to kill them? So the truth is that we're saying that he's actually saying he was avenging the deaths of his brothers. But the truth is that there's more of a point here. Again, let's keep in mind that the modern day humane concepts actually, all the liberalism and all that, it's a big change from what held sway in the world up till relatively recently. I don't know, 300-400 years ago. Less than that. Where does it come from? It's drawn off the Torah. Right? It's the Bible's influence on mankind that all concepts of humanity, humaneness, etc., made their way into the world. Just that liberalism is the most warped form. It's the most imbalanced and disproportionate form. But it all comes from the Torah. And therefore, when we're analyzing Torah, we have to draw back and realize that yes, the Torah is the big champion of compassion, and yet. Therefore, we have to look at the examples in the Torah to see when it's placed and when it's not placed. Basically, the point is, like you said, but we have to understand that Gideon, who was chosen to save the Jewish people, his job was to ensure the security of the Jewish people. And therefore, there's no room for soft-heartedness that's going to at all compromise this job. His job was to ensure the safety of the Jewish people, both in the sense that, yes, don't give these people a chance to rebuild anything, but it's also more than that. The point is to inspire fear in the hearts of the nations around, to make sure that they will know there are consequences for starting with the Jewish people. Sure, he could have been nice and he could have said, okay, look, the war is over, right? There's nothing to gain now, why should we engage in more bloodshed? But once again, Gideon knew, he had his priorities clear. He knew that his first and foremost obligation is to ensure the welfare of the Jewish people, and that if Hashem appointed him to bring about their salvation, he would be derelict in his duty by compromising that in any way. And part of the job was to get across that message. It is dangerous to start with the Jewish people. Look what happens if you do. And therefore, no, there was no room for soft-heartedness here. Even though, as we're seeing with the son, that would actually be the natural reaction for a Jew. And as we see later in Tanakh, the Jewish kings were known for that. Right? His style in those days was, that was standard practice. Accepted practice was, he conquered an area, he wiped everybody out. But the Jewish kings were known for their compassion. It says about one of the worst of kings later in Malachim. It says about Achab, right? That the Goyim knew that the Jewish kings are compassionate. They wrote on it, right? They exploited that. But again, we're talking about a true Jewish leader. Compassion, yes. etc. There's no question they had all the natures of a Jew. But he knew his job. He knew where it's meant to be implemented and where it's not meant to be implemented. You can't just let the compassion and emotions rule you. You have to know where you have to overcome them.
Why would Gideon swear in Hashem's name that he wouldn't kill them had they not killed his relatives? That's Gideon's job, is if he catches them, he should kill them.
So apparently this is part of the point. Apparently this was part of the point. On the contrary.
So then,
if they would be compassionate, that would be part of the message that he's getting across to the rest of the nations.
If you
deal compassionately with the Jewish people, you can expect compassion from us. If not, don't expect to ride on the Jewish nature of compassion. Don't expect to exploit that. Okay? No. We'll deal with you the way you deal with us.
Good question.
Now. Yeah. Vayenu ish Yisrael el Gidoy. Now, so what happens? Once again, let's take this from the perspective of the Jewish people. Right? They have been suffering under the hands of Midian for 7 years. All of a sudden, this anonymous man, Gideon, comes with a band of 300 men, destroys an army of, what we saw at the end of the day, 135,000 Midianites. He destroys them. This man turned into a national hero. And by now he's also, as we've seen last week, he also squashed any subordination, right? Anybody who tried to challenge him on the national level was dealt with very severely, we saw last week. So Gideon has established himself as a national hero. And the people, I'm using a funny word here, but almost idolized him. We'll use the word adored, okay? Because especially in this context, idolized is going to become problematic. We'll see soon. But the people adored him.
We're not talking about like close to Abu Zara.
No. But he turned into a national icon. Yeah. He turned into a national icon to the extent that the people were so enamored with him that Vayemru Ish Yisrael El Gidoin, the people of Israel said to Gidoin, Mishalban, rule over us. Listen to what they're offering him. Gamata, Gam Bincha, Gam Ben Bincha. You, your son, and your grandson. Because you saved us from the hand of Midian. Now let's understand, this is not an emotional offer coming off the top of their heads at the time. The Jewish people are making a decision here. They are ready now to appoint a royal dynasty. Right? This is a very, what's that? In the Perek Ches, Pasuk Chaf Beis. And they did this of their own accord. As we'll see soon, he certainly had no such demands. But they did this of their own accord. They got together. The admiration for him in Klal Yisrael now was so great that they were ready to grant the royalty to not just him, but to all of his posterity. That's it. They were ready to commit themselves to him and his line. So again, the point here is to understand, right? It sounds kind of natural to us. Like, why not? So, you know, it's a nice thing to do. Someone won you a war, make him king. But no, this was basically an eternal decision. Which again, for us, is meant to reflect the extent of admiration and gratitude that the Jewish people felt towards Gideon.
He was from Sheva
Menashe. Vayomer aleihem Gideon. Gideon said to them. But now, before we see Gideon's response, I want to point out the problem in what they said. And this was the problem, huh? Well, even the first generation is a problem. The problem is actually what Gideon is about to counter in his response. As we've already seen, right? But we see time and time again that the big challenge of the Jewish people always is to remain attuned to the spiritual cause and effect and not be taken by the physical cause and effect. Therefore, yes, Gideon just brought about a great salvation, but the point is to remember that the perspective, Gideon was just a conduit chosen for the salvation that Hashem chose to bring. And therefore, the primary dominant feeling should be, look what Hashem did for us. And Gideon was chosen to be the conduit.
David
Melech was a different story. He was chosen by Hashem to be king, and that's why he wrote about the salvations. But here it's coming a little bit backwards. Right? Here, the situation will always be such that it's a challenge, because people... It's much easier and even more comfortable to simply attribute things to the natural superficial level. That's why those are people talking about, like, what are Israel's problems today? The political leader, the this, the that, right? The political situation, that's usually the problem. You have people talking, you know, so bitterly about the mistakes of the government. That's this mistake. It's easier and it's even more comfortable, because then you can put a finger on it. You feel that lemaisa, even though I don't like what's going on in the government, at least it's under control in the sense that I understand. It's all within the realm of my understanding, right? It's things I could relate to. And on the contrary, right? You ask every person who discusses Israeli politics, he knows the solutions also, right? We all know the solutions. You just got to get this guy in power and that guy in power. It's much harder to constantly keep attuned to the spiritual level of things, and always remember, no. It's not because Netanyahu has no backbone. It's because Hashem wants this to be going on. And that's why he chose a person with no backbone. That is Netanyahu's claim to fame. He is the right man for the job now, because Hashem wants crazy things to be going on, so he put in a man with no backbone. It's not because Netanyahu has no backbone and the Jewish people are going through what they go through. The Jewish people never, when we're talking on the national level, it's never the result of material circumstances. On the contrary, the material circumstances are manipulated in order to set the stage the way Hashem wants it to be set.
So on this, what should be the Torah Jews approach to, let's say, with Gidon or with Bibi Lahavdil, with politics in general, the Torah Jews participation with politics, or with his, let's say, his views, what
That's a very, very broad general question. I don't want to address it right now. It's a good question. It should be addressed. Perhaps if we have a little time at the end of this year, we'll give it a few minutes. But it's a broad question. It deserves three shiur, at least. But right now, what Gideon is trying to do is put this into perspective, because he's already sensing the mistake. The admiration was a little too much. The feeling was starting to be, look what this man did for the Jewish people. Look what this man did for the Jewish people. To the extent that, right, they put all the weight onto it. They want this man to now become the king. Right? If they would really be with the understanding that no, Hashem decided that the time is ripe for our salvation. Now let's choose a candidate. A candidate who, naturally, might be not necessarily capable. But Hashem says, I'm going to imbue him with the divine spirit because I have this plan anyways. Right? Then the people wouldn't be so enamored with him. Certainly you have to be grateful to a person who did something for you, but you have to remember what the true source is. Don't think that this is the man who holds the keys to your welfare. Not true. Rav Hirsch says, it's an amazing thing, Rav Hirsch says that Moshe Rabbeinu, you know what some of his qualifications were to be the leader of the Jewish people? You know what some of his qualifications were? A, the fact that he couldn't speak well publicly. He was a stutterer, right? He couldn't present his case. That was one qualification. That's why, one of the reasons he was chosen. Of course, we're talking about the main reasons, right? Moshe Rabbeinu had the most sublime qualifications. But he says, these were important qualifications for the person who was going to become the greatest Jewish leader of all time. A person who had no rhetoric, a person who couldn't speak publicly, and a person who didn't have organizational skills. Rav Hirsch says that. You see, by Yisroi, what was going on until Yisroel came along? Moshe Rabbeinu was trying to run the affairs of the whole Jewish people single-handedly, to handle every last case. All came to him. Yisroel came up and said, why don't you set up a judicial system? Moshe said, oh wow, great idea. Rav Hirsch said something very bold. You have to be a Rav Hirsch to say this. I'm just quoting him. He said that was part of Moshe Rabbeinu's advantage. The fact that he had no idea of how to set up a nation. Right? No organizational skills. He came and he had the Eitzes of Yisroel, which might seem to us a simple Eitzah. That was part of what made him qualify. That it should be clear that he's a transparent conduit of Hashem's Hanhaga. Moshe Rabbeinu, again, our shiur now is not to talk about Moshe Rabbeinu. We can go on and on about the qualifications that Moshe had. But whatever it is, that's the point here. On the contrary, we've even seen in the case of Gideon that Hashem took pains to make it clear that this is completely supernatural. And we might even ask, why were the Jewish people making this mistake? If we saw that Hashem said Davka, right? He didn't want an army of 10,000. He boiled it down to 300. So it should be so clear. And the answer is that even when it's so clear, it'll still require a level of spiritual conscientiousness to be able to remain attuned to it, right? The superficial will always attribute it to natural causes, even when it's as clear as that. Even when it's as clear as that, what will they say? It's like they said, wow, look how great Gideon is. He was able to do it with a band of 300 men, special forces, skilled commandos, etc. For some people, it was 100% clear. For other people, that made Gideon all the greater of a warrior. Right? So, this was manifest in the Jewish people's offer to Gideon. What you did for us, you ought to be, your family should be our king forever. And therefore Gideon responds. And this is Gideon, this is why he qualified. The leader himself always does feel that transparency. And Gideon puts them in their place. And Gideon says to them, Loi emshal ani bochem, no, I won't rule over you. Veloi emshal bni bochem, nor will my son rule over you. Hashem yemshal bochem, Hashem will rule over you. So that's what I was just realizing, you know, obviously the greatness of just turning down such an offer, right? But besides that, his greatness and his omniscience. He's making this point. The truth is, this is why he was chosen for the job. This was a man who was able to feel that. And he's telling the Jewish people, Rabbosa, you're losing perspective. You can put a little bit of the credit to me, right? I'm the guy who brought it about physically, and therefore, yes, you owe me akaras hatoyes. Send me a nice mishloach manos. Fine. But that it turns into, wow, you become our king. You lost all perspective. Let's put things back into perspective. Who brought about this salvation? Who proved his capability in this little story here? It wasn't me. It was Hashem. On the contrary, the fact that, again, from Gideon's perspective, I'm not putting it this way, Gideon says that, and nobody like me could do this, should highlight all the more that this was simply Hashem. So again, these two psukim very much reflect in general this struggle that the Jewish people always lived in and lived in until today, to remain attuned to the real spiritual cause and effect, and not to get superficially caught up with, again, what you can most easily relate to, the material cause and effect, the physical cause and effect, what we see in front of us, the political cause and effect, etc.
This is not too broad of a question. What's the answers for that?
What's
that? I don't want to get caught up in that. Is that too broad?
Maintaining perspective. That's basically all it is.
Coming to this year, what?
Just not reading the news.
What's that?
Just not reading the news.
In a big sense, the truth is that yes, reading, being overly exposed to the news, overly exposed is a relative statement, but yes, the more a person involves himself in that whole world of all of the analysis of the news and the political situation, the military situation, the more a person trains himself to think on a much more surface level. Because that's what it's all full of. That's what it's all full of. I heard Rav Moshe Sternbuch say that the from newspapers, they'll yet say, you know, if it was a miraculous, Shalom Aleichem, if it was a miraculous next, right? They'll write in the papers, miraculously, a terrorist attack was averted, right? But Rav Moshe Sternbuch said, even the from newspapers won't go that final step and say, who made the miracle? You'll see, a terrorist attack was averted miraculously. That might be the headline. But somehow the word Hashem won't make it into the headline. Hashem averted a terrorist attack miraculously. Somehow that doesn't make it in. So really, yeah, the point is really, you have to work to maintain that perspective. To maintain the perspective that it's all an issue of spiritual cause and effect. But now, Vayeme Aleim Gideon. Gideon says to them, Eshala mikem she'ela utnuli. He says, no, I'm refusing your offer to become king. My family will be king forever. I don't need all that. I'm asking of you one request. Ish nezem shlole. Each person should give me one rose nose ring of what he captured. Kiniz mezav lahem. Why did he pick nose rings? Because there were a lot of nose rings there. Ki Yishma'elim hem. Because they were Yishma'elim. I mean, Midian is not exactly Yishmael. It's a different family. But Midian was very closely associated with Yishmael. And therefore they had many of the Yishma'eli customs. And apparently the nose ring was a Yishmaeli thing, and the Midianites were also very into nose rings. So therefore nose rings was maybe the most plentiful thing there. So Gideon said it was actually a small request. From all the people who had captured loot, each person should give one nose ring. It wasn't such a big deal. Gibbolites. For him, it'll be a very, very big sum. But he wasn't making such a heavy demand on the
people. What's he getting from this?
We'll see what he's getting from this. Gidain is
that because they were used for idol worship, the nose rings?
What's that?
Were the nose rings used for idol worship?
Well, the truth is that in those times, basically everything was used for idol worship. When you're talking about the idolaters, they somehow got everything in. So I don't know if the nose rings had a special idolatrous quality to them. I don't know. So, vayomru, and they said, nosein titein, absolutely, we're going to give it. Vayfrasu es hasimla, and they spread out a cloak. Vayashlichu shama ish nezem shlovei. And each person threw there a nose ring. Now again, this is not just the 300. Let's remember, like we saw earlier, it was the 300 who were conducting the main war, but there were a lot more people who were chasing the Midianites afterwards and killing them, etc. So you had very many people, and each one threw a nose ring. Vayehi mishkal nizmei hazov asher shol, and the weight of all of the nose rings that he requested, 1,700 zov. Was 1,700 weights of gold. I don't know exactly which weight this is referring to now, but it's apparently a substantial amount. Livad min ha-sa'arinim, and now this is what Gideon had. And besides this, he had all kinds of things that he had captured himself. Besides all of those moon-shaped ornaments, vanetifois, uvigdei argamon, and all of the different hanging ornaments, and all of the purple. It's like purple satin. It wasn't really satin, it was wool, but chasheva fabrics, shal malchei Midian, that were being worn by the kings of Midian. Olevad min ha'anokos asher b'tzavreg maleim, and besides all of the ornaments that were on their camels' necks. So Gideon came away with a nice substantial collection of fabrics and jewelry that he's coming home with. What does he want all this for? So once again, Gideon is loyal to the cause. Other people might have turned him into much more of a hero than he felt was right, right? But Gideon is loyal to the cause. Vayas oise Gideon le'efod. Gideon basically made out of it a big like belt or apron, an ephod, by the Kohen Gadol.
Meaning, breastplate.
What's that?
It says he had members as a breastplate with the like the shvat.
Oh, breastplate. Right. There are mafarshim that say this a yalkut shimoini. That's right. That says that he actually made a breastplate similar to the choishen out of this. So this was quite a piece. He considered that we're talking about. He took all of this gold and jewelry and basically made one, whether we'll call it an apron, a belt, a breastplate, but one article out of it. Okay. Vayatzeg oisoi be'iroi, and he hung it up in his city be'ofra, in Ofra. What for? What did he do this for? So he did it because he wanted to create a good remembrance of the miracle. In fact, the Mefarshim notes that there is actually a chiyuv to do such a thing. To commemorate, to when a miracle happens, to perpetuate it in some way. So this is what he did. He wanted to hang it up that it should be a remembrance for this miracle that Hashem did. A small handful of 300 men destroyed an army of more than 100,000. However, Vayiznu kol Yisrael acharav shal. The Jewish people strayed after it. They ultimately worshipped it. This was not during Gideon's lifetime. During Gideon's lifetime, this cult had happened. But it happened after his death. And this was for Gideon and for his home, his household, a stumbling block. Meaning Gideon made a mistake. His intentions were good, but he made a mistake. We'll discuss the nature of this shortly. And it ultimately caused a pitfall for him and his family. It caused a pitfall for his family because the Mefarshim say, as we're going to see soon, Gideon's family had a tragic end. We'll see a little later. One of his sons decided, well, Dad turned down the offer for rulership, but I'm not going to be such a loser. And he decided he was going to take the throne. And we'll see soon. There were 70, Gideon had 70 children. And this son, we're going to talk about too much now because it's coming up, wiped out all of his brothers. Don't be so horrified. This is also acceptable standard procedure in the world at large at that time. In Jewish circles it was discouraged, that sort of thing, but in the world at large that was how things worked. You also hear these stories, it's not so unusual in families of monarchy. Look, you got to ensure the throne somehow. If that's the way to do it, that's the way to do it, right? So we'll see soon. He had one child that wasn't quite as righteous as the rest of them should have been, and the Mefarshim say that it was because of what happened here. Because he set up a stumbling block for the Jewish people, the result was that his family was wiped out, his children were wiped out. Now that has to be understood a little more, because we have a principle that children are not punished for their father's mistakes. But the Mefarshim say that no, it's a little more than that. It's not just that since he made that and the Jewish people messed up with it, his children were killed. His children themselves were misled by it. Yet his own children ended up worshipping it. And that was the problem. Then you certainly do have children suffering the consequences of their parents. If parents make a bad decision that puts their child into a compromised spiritual situation, and therefore his child fails spiritually and his child suffers as a result, that does happen. You will have children suffering the result of their parents' mistakes in that sense. Parents aren't careful enough, and then the children mess up, and then the children suffer. Yes, there is such a thing. What was Gideon's mistake here? Gideon was certainly very well meaning. What was his mistake here?
He should have gone to a rav.
What's that?
He should have gone to a rav.
Oh, that's true. And what would the rav have told
him? The problem with kings.
That's very true. That's very true. That was often the problem with kings. But in this case, what would the rav have told him? Was it not a pious idea? What would the rav have told him?
There's another ephod.
What's that?
There's another ephod.
What do you mean there's another ephod?
The Kohen Gadol.
Oh, the Kohen Gadol has his own ephod. Okay, so we're getting to something
here. We're telling that the door of idolatry, if that's what the nation is doing now, falling into, have to be very careful not to do anything that will...
Okay, so the truth is that each of you are starting to get onto a different track, both of which the Mefarshim discuss. So let's start with your track, because I think that that's the simpler understanding. The claim against Gideon was very nice, he had a very nice idea, but at the end of the day, once again, we've already been seeing earlier that we're talking about a generation in which idolatry was a danger. And on the contrary, we saw how Hashem was so careful with who he selected to represent him. It was the people who understood that when you're living in a generation where there's an epidemic of idolatry, it's not enough just to not worship idolatry. You have to make sure to take all the measures you can to make sure that idolatry is as distanced as possible, and to make sure that your house is, your home is as insulated as possible from idolatry. And therefore, who are the ones who are actually chosen for the army? It was the people who never kneeled. Right? Not in idolatry or not in idolatry. People are getting involved with idolatry, we are never going to kneel again. People will never get down on all fours. Right? So therefore, yes, Gideon had a very good idea. And Gideon might have said, well, come on, it's as clear as day what the purpose of this ephod is. But no, that's the point. When you're in a spiritually polluted environment, you have to be extra careful to make sure that your environment is as sterile as it can possibly be. And therefore, Gideon should have been careful. Now, the way the Mefarshim put it, if I remember correctly, it's Min Chutana, says that yes, it was a very good idea, but there were other such instances in history of events that warranted commemoration. For example, what's that? Oh, there was the Nechash and Nechash that was destroyed. But there were cases of people who wanted actually to create some sort of remembrance for an event. There were a couple of such examples. When David killed Goliath, this is later in history. Okay, we're looking ahead to the future. When David killed Goliath, they displayed the sword as a remembrance. But where?
No,
in the Mishkan.
In Hashem's headquarters, that's where they put that sword. There's no room for mistakes there. When you come in, you're in Hashem's throne room, and there's a sword there on the floor. The sword isn't the dominant presence in the room, right? Hashem, Yes, this is the Kodesh HaKadoshim. There's a sword there too. Or the box. Remember when the Polishtim sent the box back after they were defeated by the Arn of Hashem?
The golden box.
Oh, what was that? Put in the Mishkan. Right? Bet Shemesh. It's a local story. Maybe the old timers among us remember. But it was put in the Mishkan. Gideon didn't do that.
The ark that was sent around the Jackson?
That's right. That's right.
Can I mention something that I might not know really well because it came in late? In the news today, the Japanese archaeological team has found the first Canaanite doorpost.
Doorpost?
Doorpost. And when I read the article, I remember learning that one of the kings of Israel did away with all the idol worship. And so some of the Jews disguised their doors.
That's right, Yoshio.
I forget which Gomorrah it is, but in fact, when the doors are closed, you can see the idol worship. But
that's
when
right.
Open,
Yoshio. Much later in history than
that. Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. So they found that?
So maybe.
Maybe that's that?
You have the
well, we'll be getting there, but at the rate we're going, it's going to be.
Right, then we can tell them what they found.
Oh, we'll have to let them know.
Yeah.
So that was Gideon. Gideon was very well meaning, but his mistake was at the end of the day he kept it home. Right? You're doing something like this, you put it in the Mishkan. And that way you make sure to avoid any mistakes. Now the truth is that you mentioned something also. You mentioned that the fact that this is not really the original ephod is also based on what you said before. There's an ephod in the Mishkan. Kohen Gadol was one of the things he wore. Chazal say in Yalkut Shemoni, one of the understandings of Gideon's purpose in making this ephod was that there were 12 stones on the ephod. How many shvatim were there?
13.
There were 13. Which shevet was missing on the ephod?
Menashe.
Shevet Menashe. Shevet Menashe was missing on the ephod.
Wasn't there
Yosef
on the ephod?
What's that?
So the flying of the
I don't remember exactly how it works
the
out.
Flying or the
I'm not sure.
You might say Yosef. Like the flying was the more. Here it says the flying was the more dominant tribe.
Of so Yosef.
Yeah.
Somehow or the other, I don't remember the detail. But Chazal say that Menashe was missing.
Menashe was the assistant to Yosef in Egypt.
That's true.
He was very much.
But he was subordinate. In Lamaise, at the end of the day, once the tribes developed, the Frank was the much more prestigious among the two. As we was also saying the whole story with Gideon. And Gideon wanted to make that up.
Yeah,
sure. Right, Yeshua, that's right. So Gideon wanted to make that up. He was going to make up the what was missing, for his, what his tribe was missing up until now. This also is a mistake.
Is it a covet thing?
What's that?
So is it a bit of a covet thing?
You might call it covetous tribe, which is a legitimate feeling. Covetous tribe. But this also was a mistake. This was a mistake. Flamaisa, that's how the Torah set it up. Right? Don't come and supplement. Don't come and fix up. Right? That's the Isra of Baal Tosef.
Does that mean the Isra of Baal Tosef did then?
No. It wasn't the Isra of Deraisa of Baal Tosef, because the Isra of Deraisa of Baal Tosef would have been to put a 13th stone on the breastplate. But on the conceptual level, that was the problem. But whatever it is, this was a mistake, coming from a good place, but it was a mistake. Now, Vayikona Midian Lefnei Bnei Yisrael. But at the end of the day, this we mentioned in parentheses, it was a little bit of an unpleasant element to this story. But Lamaise, Gideon came back victorious. Gideon had brought about this great salvation. And at this point still, everything was fine. He made a beautiful remembrance for Hashem of the nace that had happened. And Midian, if we want to appreciate the extent of the victory, this is something that I don't know if we find anywhere else. Vayikona Midian lefnei bnei Yisrael, the people of Midian were subdued before the bnei Yisrael. Ve'lo yasfu lases roisham, and they never raised their heads again, not for a long time, never. He had completely laid them low. They were finished with Midian. Vatishkoy ta'oretz arboim shana bimei Gidoy. And the land was quiet for 40 years in the days of Gideon. That's, again, I always stress how we have to note these things. A lot of times when you read through Nach, you get the impression of one problem after the other. But it's just kind of between the lines of, oh, and then things were quiet for 40 years. Things were quiet for 40 years. It means that there was a period of 40 years where the Navi had no complaints, where the Jewish people were living righteously. In the days of Gideon. Vayelech Now, there's some question among the Mepharshim. Does this include, does it mean 40 years altogether from when the oppression started until the end of the 40 years? Or does it mean that after he defeated Midian there was a period of 40 years? But even if we'll assume that it included the period of the oppression, the period of the oppression was 7 years. So we're talking about 7 years to 33 years. So you see that, yes, in the big picture, the Jewish people were doing pretty nicely. Vayelech Yehu Ba'al ben Yoyosh, Vayeshev Beveisai. And Yerubbaal, remember that was Gideon's other name, right? That he was given when he destroyed the altar of the Baal. So he was dubbed the name, the one who picked the fight with the Baal. Right? He went and he sat in his home. Now this is being stressed. Meaning he basically remained the leader of the Jewish people, although again he refused to be the ruler. Went back home, lived like a commoner. Well, nicely, he was the shofet for the rest of his life.
And who was it?
But Gideon.
This is like Dwight David Eisenhower after he became president and went back to his farm.
Well, the difference is that he continued leading the Jewish people and caring for the Jewish people until the end of his life. Just he did not do so in the capacity of a king. He sat back in the same home he had always lived in, humble home, back in the area of Abiezer, right? And for the next 40 years, the Jewish people were in his care, but there was no pomp, there were no bodyguards, there were no nothing. He sat at home in his old neighborhood like ever before. He didn't even renovate. He had an ephod hanging in his house. That was the effect. He says also he was able to sit quietly because there were indeed no more problems for the rest of his life. Olegidain hayushiv im banim. Gideon had 70 sons. Yetzei Reichoi. Now we're already starting to preface the problems that are going to develop after he dies. Kinoshim Raboi Sayuloi. Because he had many wives. So he had 70 sons. Ufilagsho Asher Bishchem. Among his many wives, he had one Pilegesh, one concubine. Yoldoloi Gam Hiben. She also bore him a son. Vayosan is Shemoi Avimelech, and he called him Avimelech. Interesting choice of a name, right? We don't necessarily have good association with that name, and we won't have good association with this one either.
What does Shechem have to do with
that? What's that? That's where she lived. Vayomos Gideon ben Yoyosh v'seva toivo. And Gideon ben Yoyosh died in a ripe old age. Vayikover bekever Yoyosh Oviv, and he was buried in the grave of Yoyosh, his father, beOfra Avio Ezri, in the territory of Ofra, the area of the Avi Ezri family of Menashe. So this ends the story of one of the people who just really epitomizes what a Jewish leader is. Unassuming, not looking and actually resisting the fame, the glory and the honor, who earned his qualifications through his deep care and concern for the Jewish people. Also inspiring about the story of Gideon is that, as we've seen before, he wasn't from a prestigious family, wasn't the famous person, but Hashem notices every last anonymous Tom, Dick and Harry, sees greatness where other people might not. And therefore he was singled out by Hashem where nobody else would have believed it, and he was singled out for the leadership. Okay, we'll take a couple of minutes now. I put your question off to the end. We'll just take 2-3 minutes to begin addressing what should really be 2-3 hours. And you asked, so how do we lamaisa relate to the things that we see going on at the end of the day? If we'll take as the case in point what's going on in Eretz Yisrael now, that can include a lot of things. It can include the war that's threatening to break out. It can include the whole situation with what's going on with the army, the budget, etc. It doesn't take much to see that, is there not a connection between the two? Is there not a connection that at the same time that Israel is trying to destroy, that the Israeli government is trying to destroy whatever Kedusha was supporting up till now, or whatever Kedusha was legitimizing up till now, and now it's being threatened from the outside. Again, if you just view it on the level of natural cause and events, these are two things that one doesn't have much to do with the other, right? One is the result of foreign developments, and the other is the result of inner politics. But again, if you're viewing things from the cause of spiritual cause and effect, this is one thing that should be easy to notice. But besides that, Stam, how do we relate to it? So on the one hand, so you have people who are, in a general way, whenever there's a tzara facing the Jewish people, the natural response always has to be not, well, what's the cause of it? You know, how did this develop? It's because this.
Who do we blame?
What's that? Oh, exactly. Who do we blame? Etc. And, you know, if so and so would be in power, you know, that would be different. These things are always meant, number one, is a wake up call to us. Hashem is saying, Yom Ne'raim are coming. I want to see you stepping up your efforts. Maybe the Jewish people aren't aware of me enough. They need a wake up call. We always respond, this is a cloud. We don't know why Hashem does things. At the same time, Hashem gives us very clear directives as to how to explain it to ourselves. And Hashem says, explain it to ourselves as a call for action, a call for spiritual action. That's how the Rambam puts it down at the beginning of Hilchos Tainis, to improve our ways, to see what is it that we can do better, right, in order to avoid these situations that are coming up. And the same goes for also the things that we see being leveled against the from community, the Torah community as a whole. On the one hand, we have to call spades spades. And if people are, if there are wicked people in the government, it has to be very clear that they're wicked. But at the same time, let's not just say, well, okay, this is a guy who grew up in the home of one of the biggest Torah haters of the Israeli state, right, Lapid. And that's why this is happening. No, we have to take it as a call from Hashem to us. For us, the message is, Hashem is saying, 1 minute, up till now, capability to learn Torah, right? Yeshivas, the existence of yeshivas is something you took for granted. Maybe it's not being utilized enough. None of us here are actually in yeshiva, and therefore, whatever learning we're doing is not being threatened by what's going on. But at the same time, we should understand that it's a message to us that Hashem is saying, whereas up till now it was easier to learn Torah in Eretz Yisrael, now I'm making it more difficult. That's to be taken as a message that perhaps we're not utilizing the opportunity enough. It's so easy to learn today. There's so much available, right? English, Hebrew, all the modern publications that are out that just make it so easy. There's so much available. Are we utilizing it? Perhaps Hashem says, if it's not being utilized enough, I'm going to threaten to take it away. Now let's see you jump. Right? So primarily, we're supposed to take this as a message to us. But I think the Mili used to put it into very extreme terms. It used to make people upset. He said, Hashem spoke through the mouth of Hitler. What were some of the things that Hitler said initially? What were the first Nuremberg laws? Right? What were the first Nuremberg laws? These were things that the Gedolei Torah was saying all the time. Jews should not be marrying German women, right? Jews should not be attending the Goyish schools, etc., etc. Right? So, what the Gedolei Torah said and nobody listened, Hitler came and said the same thing, and now they had to listen. It's illegal for a Jew to marry a non-Jew. That's Hitler talking. Right? You have to see the you have to be connected to the true cause and effect. That's in a nutshell. This is obviously a very broad discussion, and we didn't even begin it. But that's enough for not beginning it.